Good morning, everyone. My name is Aisho, and I'm on the teaching staff here at the Zendo. So right now, half a century has passed since some of the momentous events of the civil rights movement back in the mid-60s. And while we don't see the level of kind of violent societal racism that was evident then, racism certainly continues today. And what I want to talk about this morning is a difficult topic, really to look at the personal aspects of racism, how we ourselves can experience prejudice against others, how despite our good intentions, we can be unconscious perpetrators of racism, and why our Zen practice is so important if we want to and are willing to work deeply with this. So it was exactly 50 years ago this month, April of 1963, that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was jailed in Birmingham, Alabama, for his role in organizing a nonviolent protest against segregation in that city. And while he was in jail, he began to write a letter. And some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with this letter. Because his jailers would not allow him writing paper, he wrote the letter on margins of newspapers. And he would give the newspapers to his lawyers to secretly carry out to the outside world. And this letter from Birmingham Jail is one of Dr. King's powerful and inspired writings. And in responding to questions as to what he was doing in Birmingham and why he was, in the words of some, creating trouble there, he writes that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. So this network of mutuality is, of course, something very familiar to us in the framework of Zen. But at the same time, it's a truth that is bigger than Buddhism or any particular religious path or political view. What affects one directly affects all indirectly. So at the time that Dr. King was in the Birmingham jail, I was in the first grade and a little too young to understand the significance of what he was saying or what the emerging civil rights movement was all about. But what I did know were the images that were on the nightly TV news that year and in the years that would follow. Some of the ugliest scenes of deep racial hatred, of police officers with clubs, of beatings, of tear gas, snarling dogs unleashed on nonviolent protesters, marchers in the South. So what were we to make of these images and the fear and hatred going on in that time? So some of you who are here this morning will be staying for our practice group, The Path of the Ox, this afternoon. And as part of this practice group, we've been looking at stories. We're using the word stories, but it really includes beliefs, the beliefs of our families and our culture when we were growing up, value sets about what was important, about our role in our own family, about how society should be, about the way the world is. Those kinds of stories. And of course, those kinds of stories include stories about money, about class, about gender, and they include stories about race. So it's difficult for us to see some of these stories or this conditioning because some of this has been really hardwired into us. This conditioning becomes part of the lens with which we see and experience and create our reality. And many times we don't see. We're not aware of this lens of conditioning. And as a result, it's never really questioned. So when it comes to racism, I've been reflecting on the stories around race that I grew up with. And of course, with these things, it's not like there really are intentional conversations that happen. All of this is a lot more subtle, a lot more kind of implicit. The bits of conversation we overhear, the remarks that are made, the way we see people treated. Studies have shown that children as young as 3 are already picking up racial attitudes, long before they have any understanding of them. So my mother, who would be 96 years old if she was still living, grew up in the Jim Crow South. Segregation was not just a way that people lived, it was the law of the land. And it permeated everything, all aspects of life. At the same time, my mother was partially raised, as were many children of that era in the South, by an African-American housekeeper. My mother called her Aunt Lou. I don't know Lou's last name. Kind of been lost in the mists of time. But in my mother's old scrapbook, there's a tiny photograph of her, really just a cutout of her face. And Lou was born a slave. She was a child during the Civil War and was freed by Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. So that time of slavery seems a long time ago, but when I look at my mother's scrapbook, I'm reminded that this time is not that far away at all. And of course, the legacy of that time in America is still with us today. So here's an excerpt of a piece by a columnist writing in a Florida newspaper that I just happened to see because I was passing through an airport and it was left there on a seat and I was looking at it. This was right after the killing of Trayvon Martin. Here's what this columnist writes. He says, as a black person, I live race. I'm always acutely aware that my race constitutes what is referred to as primary status. That is, in the eyes of whites and other non-blacks, my skin color is the most important piece of information about me. This condition is inescapable. Race confounds our understanding because, in addition to being ever present, it is lived subconsciously by the victim and the perpetrator in a complex mix of conflicting sentiments, evasions, and often degrading actions and reactions. So I doubt that many of us here in the Zendo this morning consider ourselves racist. You know, when we think of racists, we think of extremists, the people we read about who commit appalling, unthinkable hate crimes. Yet we're not seeing racism clearly if we limit it to something that's only done by extremists that we vilify. And I'd like to just read with you a few short definitions of racism that look at this really from a Dharma perspective, look at it more deeply. So here's one. Racism is not necessarily about believing in stereotypes. It is being steeped in the cultural ego's fear of the other without being aware of how deeply it is in us. Here's another definition. Racism is about seeing people as other in such a systematic way that it becomes an entrenched habit that we are not even aware of. It is racial mindlessness. And here's a third. Aversion and avoidance are the two primary and most insidious forms of racism in the U.S. today. This also involves denial of seeing that people of color live in a different world. It is the racism of ignorance, of not seeing, of being unaware. It is subtle. It is everywhere. So the common thread in these definitions is the unawareness that we don't see. It's like a deliberate not seeing that in Buddhism is called ignorance. And if we are to wake up, we need to see what is going on around us and inside us more clearly. This is healing self and healing others. So some of the stories that we could bring to the surface and explore are the stories and beliefs, the conditioning that we inherited about racial issues. Whether we are a person of color or whether we are a person who is white, we have inherited stories and conditioning around race. And if we don't make these stories conscious, there's a good chance we're going to continue to see the world and experience the world through other people's belief systems. And every time we bring one of these stories up to daylight and take a look at it, there is a little more liberation from it. So even if you feel that none of this really applies to you this morning, you know, it's important to recognize this conditioning is still there in the mind. You can't live in this society and not have absorbed some of this conditioning. It's going to manifest in our thoughts and emotions around race, around racially tinged things that we see, that we read about, that we hear about. I would like to deny this about my own mind, to say it isn't true of my mind because I abhor racism. But if I'm not looking at what can surface in my own mind, then I'm in denial. And whatever is there is still going to have some power. And we start to disempower this conditioning when we can see it, observe it, see it for the conditioning that it is. And when we can see that, we have a choice of how we can respond. So the question is, can we use our Zen training and our Zen practice to deeply examine our conditioning? To look closely, without denial, without judgment, without shame, at our thoughts and emotions that arise around race. For those of us who are white, can we start to look at ways that we can embody an unconscious attitude of white privilege? And I think this is where our Zen practice and how we work with the mind is so essential. You know, what is required is the commitment to practice, to examine all of what passes through the mind. If we have a thought with racial overtones or an emotion around race that kind of ripples through consciousness, can we see it? You know, in our practice, we really want to try to see all of it, to not let thoughts pass unnoticed. Thoughts about ourselves, thoughts about others, thoughts about the way things should be or shouldn't be. To really be that impeccable in our practice and to have the courage and meticulousness to see and acknowledge what is there. To really cultivate this kind of fearless transparency, transparency to ourselves of what is there. So it's only when we really have the willingness to look that we experience more freedom, and otherwise unexamined, this stuff just festers. We might even start to believe it. The great thing about practice is that all of it, everything that comes up, is grist for the mill. You know, this talk today, you know, I'm focusing on issues around racism, but it's not just racism. It's about all the ways we push away otherness, religion, ethnicity, class, sexual preference, age. It's all this otherness out there. And when we look closely, you know, we can see that the mind can be filled with judgments and opinions and aversions. These are things we make self from. We can look at that. As we would say in some of our Zen chants, all our twisted ancient karma, born of our body, mouth, and thought. So here's the Zen teacher Alan Sinaki talking about racism and how we can practice with it. And this is his guidance to us. He says, we try to uncover our own thought patterns. This is painful and embarrassing, but is the essence of saving myself and saving all sentient beings. It is amazing to see the stories that we can make up about other people and how these stories are conditioned by race, class, and privilege. This is why we need a mindfulness practice where we watch our thoughts about race or about any kind of difference. So I don't know if Roshi will remember this, but once, a long time ago, I went to see her in Dokusan. And I remember that it took me quite a while to work up my courage to talk to her about this because I was afraid of what she would think of me. And I told her that I felt ashamed of some of the thoughts that could come into my mind on the subway. thoughts about race, thoughts about class, thoughts about ethnicity, all of it. And I told her with a fair amount of shame that, you know, these thoughts weren't my values. They weren't how I wanted to be. But there they were. And Roshi gave me a great teaching in a couple of words, almost in a casual way, but it's interesting how these things always stay with you. She said, "Oh, that's just conditioning. Just see it. Not a big deal, and yet a big deal. Just what manifests in the conditioned mind." You know, in my own experience, when I will see thoughts, emotions around race ripple through, around ethnicity, class, all of it, I found it really is helpful to, I try to have almost a little mental smile, like, "Oh, look at that, uh-huh, okay, there's that conditioning. Maybe you thought you didn't have that anymore, uh-huh, there it is. You're tired, you're stressed, you're hot, it's too crowded, somebody just said something, ah, okay, there it is. Breathe in, breathe out." So in working with the racism or pushing away of otherness that we may encounter in our own minds, I think it's really important that we remember one of the profound and difficult and liberating teachings of the Buddha, when he tells us to take nothing whatsoever as me or mine. Right? All of it, a flow of conditioned things arising, passing away, all of it non-self. Although each of us has different kinds of thoughts, different kinds of thought patterns, none of us own our thoughts or control our thoughts. You know, when we quickly see when we sit down to practice Zazen that thoughts are not under our control. I was having a vivid reminder of that this morning. What we do find in Zazen is thoughts without a thinker. Each one of us has negative thoughts, loving thoughts. And from a practice standpoint, they're all just thoughts. They arise under certain conditions, and they pass away. We don't have to take ownership. So I'll just give you an example of something that, this may seem minor, but it's something I've been working with recently. So a while back, I read an article in the op-ed section of the New York Times. And it was written by an African-American man, a professional, who wondered why, on trains, white people didn't sit next to him. And that story really hit me. Was I one of those people? I was filled with kind of a shame just even thinking that. Really? Could I be one of those people? So when you sit on a train, where you sit on a train, in a waiting room, all of these kinds of things is a really interesting place to observe how unconscious conditioning manifests. So when I really took a step back and looked at what happened in choosing a seat on a train, I realized that the first thing I probably look for, as a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure it's the first thing I look for, is I'm looking for somebody to sit next to who looks not crazy and looks kind of reasonably quiet. You know, like they're not going to be, you know, if they're already yelling into their cell phone, I'm not going to go there. This is just kind of being practical. But then I started looking a little more deeply, and I thought, I realized I probably look for somebody kind of like me, female, probably middle-aged, probably white. all of this largely, if not totally, unconscious to me until I read that article and it became a lot more conscious for me. And I decided I was going to work with this. I didn't want to be driven by that. So in working with it, when I came into a train or a waiting room and I had a choice of seats, I thought, I'm going to make a deliberate choice here. I'm going to choose someone who looks other, whatever it is. I don't care what it is. And I'd sit down and I'd say hello. That's it. I don't want to have a chat, but just sit down and say hello. So externally, not a big thing at all. But internally, there's something more to it, which is it's coming out of the trance. It's coming out of the trance where we make choices that we're not even aware that we're making. That's Dharma. So I'd like to just wrap up with a teaching from Thich Nhat Hanh. And he is talking about how we can work with the suffering that rises up from the past. And that could be our own personal past, personal pain, or it could be at the societal level. He's really talking about both. And he says this, he says, if we are standing firmly in the present, we can see that the ghosts of the past, which follow us into the present, also belong to the present moment. To observe these ghosts deeply is to transform them. So through our attention, through our presence, we don't have to be bound by these ghosts of the past and these ghosts of our conditioning. This is healing the present for ourselves and for all sentient beings.